From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1996 when a Venezuelan woman named Alicia Machado won the Miss Universe competition. She was 19 years old and later said that she had undergone such intense dieting that she was suffering from a disorder during the competition. She described herself privately as both anorexic and bulimic. She weighed 116 pounds. After winning the crown, Machado gained some weight. She later wrote she thought she gained about 12 or 15 pounds. The new owner of the Miss Universe competition was Donald Trump, and he thought she was gaining a lot more weight, more than he wanted. Trump complained publicly that Machado was, quote, an eating machine. He indicated she could lose her crown if he wasn't satisfied with her weight. Trump then arranged for dozens of reporters to come see Miss Universe in New York, but it turned out they were there for one of her workouts. Trump said he thought she would be more motivated to lose weight if she understood that people were watching. By now, you know that Machado's story became a campaign issue. Trump has continued to bash her, calling her a problem and very selfish. But Alicia Machado is not the only woman that Donald Trump has body shamed. He's done it for decades. And let's get serious for a moment. Our country does have a weight problem. We have a childhood obesity problem. But research shows generally poor results when we shame people. So the question is, what does work? This hour, a conversation about our health and how to encourage one another. My guests include Dr. Steve Cook. He's an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics and the Center for Community Health at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Cook, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Evan.
And Dr. Tom Campbell's here, chair of the Department of Family Medicine and executive director of the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Campbell, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
You know, I promised to our guests we're not going to focus on one person, one candidate the entire hour. We've heard enough of that. But a lot of our listeners, I think, maybe haven't heard the public comments from the time. So, again, take yourself back to 1997. Alicia Machado had been Miss Universe. And this is what Donald Trump and Howard Stern said on the Stern show about her and the weight gain.
It's almost a fraud here. You pass yourself off. For 1 year, keep yourself under control. Learn to diet.
And isn't there a clause that says she can only gain so much weight?
More or less, yes. You whip this fat slob into shape. I don't know how you did it. I see all these diet plans, everything else. God bless you. Seriously, how did you whip this gargantuan woman into shape?
Well, you know, it was an amazing phenomenon. She weighed 118.
Right.
And when she won, I don't know if you saw the contest last year. It was from Las Vegas.
She was beautiful.
When she won, she was as beautiful a woman as I've ever seen.
She looked like Cindy Crawford.
Right. She gained about 55 pounds in a period of 9 months.
She
was like
that?
An eating machine.
What does a girl eat to gain 50? I mean, in less than a year to gain...
She must never stop.
I mean, where was she...
I guess she ate a lot of everything.
And oh, my God. I mean, her bowel movements. How many did she have a day?
Terminate her crown, you know, her Miss Universe reign.
No, you were smart. You turned it into an event. You said, listen...
It has become a major event.
That's Donald Trump talking to Howard Stern on that show there. I mean, Dr. Cook, what do you make of that conversation?
It's disgusting. It really is. I mean, it gets at the epitome of the thought that controlling eating, controlling weight is as simple as a personal choice. And the fact is, it's bullying at its best. And I'm not surprised in the 1990s and Howard Stern. So it really is a significant problem. It's far more complicated than... move more, eat less. There are metabolic underpinnings. There are neuroendocrine problems. There's a lot of emotional factors. And as we've come to learn out, Ms. Machado also suffers from mental health problems where, you know, her control of eating is a problem. So it's pretty disgusting. And as a father, you know, I have young daughters, and trying to not have all these additional pressures on daughters and then this type of behavior is just really bothersome. Mm.
Dr. Campbell?
Well, I think it gets to the heart of, you know, how do we value other people around us? And it's sort of getting to this idea that someone's value is essentially defined by their body shape or their body weight. And we know that's actually integrally linked to a variety of eating disorders and maladaptive eating behaviors. And, you know, this just reinforces all of that dangerous behavior. And it's really, it's pretty gross and unhelpful, I would say.
And by the way, credit to where it's due, BuzzFeed is the source for the audio there. Dr. Campbell, when it comes to that kind of commentary, is there a risk that there's millions of people listening to the CERN show every day, still are. Does that normalize it in the minds of some of the listeners that, hey, this is what you do, and this is how you talk about people?
Sure, and that's been a larger conversation about this whole presidential election, at large, of course, with a variety of topics, but You know, what's socially normal or social norms in our society is incredibly important. And this idea of valuing other people simply by their appearance or someone's worth by their weight or their body shape and making that normal is really quite dangerous for us as a society, I think.
Dr. Cook, I know you have talked in the past on this program just about the danger in the kinds of shaming and the way people handle that. I mean, even if your actual goal is to help somebody, you may be hurting them and making the problem worse, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the underlying thought, you know, was how do you motivate her? Well, we can motivate the heck out of anyone if you throw enough sticks and carrots, if you apply behavior economics at it. The problem is that that is an unhealthy way. You know, it's fine if you're just assembling widgets and you need to do as many as you can as fast as you can. It doesn't require creativity. When you're talking about, you know, individual health behaviors, to simplify that, you know, in such a simple manner leads to lots of health problems. Not just the denigrating of a person based on appearance by objectifying them in that way, but also that people will take shortcuts to get there. And so what it is they do to lose weight becomes usually unhealthy strategies. And then the emotional damage that comes with it. And then metabolically, we know the body doesn't respond and just snap back and say, okay, we'll stay at this weight now. So there are a number of things that make it more complicated. And Tom's point is right on that, you know, it's placing a value on a person based on a physical appearance. It's really like the last lesson we want to teach our children and our society.
Yeah. Well, listeners, if you want to jump into the conversation this hour, you can do that. The number's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Tim is first up. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes. Hi. Evan, I just wanted to offer a comment on a kind of a different plane of things here and the issues in the comments of the panel in response. Basically, my sense is that the kind of behavior that Donald Trump has represented to us the last several months and certainly over the weekend and last night, I think really provides an enormous opportunity for us as men in this culture to engage in a level of conversation, first of all, internally or interiorly, within ourselves and then with each other, on to what extent have we participated in the manifestation of kind of patriarchal energy? Domination, from domination to you know, the thing that came up over the weekend in terms of groping and sexual, sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's simply this. It's the desire to launch a national conversation within and among men about how, first of all, you know, how each of us as men can relate to some part of his egregious, offensive, oppressive experience in relating to women. And you know, this piece obviously on weight is germane and expressive. So it's in some ways thanking Trump for providing us culturally with this opportunity to take a look at who we are, to take a look at gender relations on a wholly different and deeper level. And finally, the responsiveness on social media of the issues around the tape that whole piece, I think, are expressive of the fact that it is it's kind of touching a fundamental, stone, some kind of energy core within gender relations that is that's enormous. So, long story short, I'm just feeling that you know what his behavior represents to me, kind of the death throes of what some people call patriarchy.
Well, and Tim, I thanks for that, and I appreciate that, but. I have to say here, you know, a couple of points here. Just in regards to the tape and all that stuff, which is a subject for another day, polls have come out indicating that Trump voters are not only unmoved by that, but there's a portion of them who want to vote for him more after that. So I don't know that we're in the death throes of this weird, problematic way that men talk about women or men assault or treat women. I don't know. I mean, maybe that would be great, I think. But Tim, to the doctors on the panel, Tim is seeing this in regards to the question on gender. So do we know, in terms of, let's say, eating disorder or obesity, et cetera, is this more likely to be young girls and adult women or not? Tom?
Yeah, sure. I mean, anorexia and bulimia are much more common among women, okay. Among females. There's another eating disorder, binge eating disorder, that is less sex preferential for women. I mean, it's common in men too, but not as common as females. So we know that these are more common among women.
Okay. Dr. Cook?
Yeah, I mean, while there is a component to it and it should not be diminished or anything, what we're talking about in terms of fat shaming is not just on a physical basis. Men and women are discriminated against in the job setting, in the work setting, in educational settings, in the healthcare setting, based on weight. And so, yes, there is a component that is sexist as well, highlighted by Mr. Trump, but there's many components to it. And I don't want to undersell the importance of what this gentleman was talking about. And I think as a dad and as men, we do have an important role to try to address this, not tolerate this. But it's also something that doesn't just occur to women. It occurs to both genders.
Yeah, and to Tim's not with us on the phone anymore, but I would just say, you know, maybe he is referring to our society's way of putting more value on women if we think they're attractive, and men certainly. Anybody who's overweight can be sort of discriminated against. Doesn't matter. But, you know, you could look at sitcoms where the overweight guy gets the attractive woman, you know, over and over and over again. Look at the way we talk about, no, not we, certainly not me, Donald Trump, others talk about Miss Universe contests and the way we value women if they're more sort of fitting in the small box of what's attractive. So I take Tim's point there. But I think the broader conversation is simply about what is effective and what's not when it comes to health and weight. So, Tim, thank you for that phone call. John in Rochester, though, thinks there might have been a value in what Trump was saying. John, is that right?
Yeah. I wanted to bring that point up. But before I say that, Evan, I got to say, what is this, the CNN, the Clinton News Network? I mean, a lot of your topics seem to be anti-Trump. It sounds a little.
Did you listen to the last
say,
hour?
Little,
did you?
It
did
sounds
you listen?
A little biased to me.
Oh no! John, I'm biased against Trump. It's okay. I can own it here. You're not like breaking any news here. I've said on this program that we are in a weird election, where it has been very difficult for me because I have a lot of respect for people on all sides of the political aisles, and I think there's something very troubling at the gate that is authoritarian, that denigrates people of across the spectrum, people with disabilities. I think you have to stand up and be counted eventually.
Well,
and I'm not afraid of that. But
well,
go ahead.
Okay, I understand that, and I'll respect you for that. But what about Hillary Clinton demeaning and trying to discredit Bill Clinton's rape victims?
Okay,
have you brought that out?
We're going to talk about that later this week. John, we're going to talk about that later this week. Did you listen last hour? That's an honest question.
No, I did not.
Okay, last hour was all about the bank transcripts and the audio from February in which Hillary Clinton told donors things that were different than she was telling voters. And we analyzed how it is difficult to discern where she's going to govern, because publicly she says things that are different than what she says privately. She's acknowledged that. She says it's sort of a tactic of governing, the same way that Lincoln.
Are you going to talk about her demeaning of Bill's rape?
John.
But okay, let's get off this. I do have a question.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Okay. I did hear a press conference that Trump did right around, I guess, 1996. I heard it over the weekend. And he actually sounded very diplomatic. He got a trainer for this lady, and he sounded pretty, very diplomatic, and the opposite of what was talked about on Howard Stern. Now Howard Stern actually is a funny guy. It's a funny show. I heard a tape when Megyn Kelly, remember the incident when Megyn Kelly had, Trump said Megyn Kelly had blood in her eye and all
that
stuff?
Yes,
well,
of course.
Well, Megyn Kelly, a few weeks before that, a few months before that, was on a Howard Stern show talking about her husband's penis size with Howard Stern and joking around. So Howard Stern is a... I have to say, I heard this take that you guys just played.
Yeah.
It was pretty funny.
Okay. That was funny to you. I didn't find it funny. And we're going to agree to disagree on that. The question beyond is it funny is, does it work? So let's try to keep our eyes on the topic this hour. I'm sorry, guys. Sorry to our doctors in studio here. We kind of got off the rails a little bit here. I'm trying to look through actual studies here of what works and what doesn't here. And I think, in my stack of notes, there is research that shows that stigmatizing overweight people leads to psychological factors that are likely to contribute to more weight gain. Things like depression, binge eating, which is what Dr. Campbell mentioned, and a paper published 3 years ago takes it a step further, linking what the internet likes to call fat shaming to weight gain and suggesting that you can't scare people into being skinny. So, John, if that was funny to you, demeaning someone for weight gain, okay, but let's also talk about what works, and Trump claimed he was just trying to help her. I don't. Dr. Cook, does that sound like he's trying to help her?
You know, in 1996, he might have thought that, but the reality is that, you know, we have evidence. We have science. You know, if John believes the world is round and the moon's not made out of cheese and we understand evidence, then we're on the same field here. If John doesn't want to acknowledge and believe evidence and science, then I can't help him. And the evidence shows that these types of behaviors, this approach, and at times in a short term can be helpful, but in the long term is harmful. And, you know, there's increasing evidence about that. And we're seeing this type of behavior being role modeled and continued. And so if you look at what he thinks is funny is actually bullying and is demeaning, you're now looking at the most common reason kids are identified or kids are teased or bullied in schools today. It's not sexual orientation. It's not disability or race. It's weight. It's kids who identify or is identified as being obese or called fat or whatever term you want to use. They're denigrated. They're bullied, not only by peers, educational systems. Teachers perceive obese children as being slower and lazier, whether it's an implicit or explicit bias. So it's, you can call it funny. The evidence and science proves otherwise.
All right, listeners, let me put a direct appeal out for callers because the phone's been ringing. But let me put out a direct appeal to calls that are not Trump-related but more related to your own experience. You know, if you're willing to share it, if you're willing to talk about, you know, I think every single person, no matter your fitness, no matter your weight, no matter your size, can relate to occasionally not being happy with how you look, how you feel, the challenge to feel better. You know, I have a big amount of privilege here. I mean, I've got a great metabolism. I recognize that privilege for sure. But I can still relate to days where you don't feel great. And if you want to share your stories on what has worked for you and what didn't work, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. 263-9994. Let me close the loop on one other thing for our friend John. I mentioned how I feel about the Republican candidate. I don't think he's actually a Republican, and I don't have a problem with the party writ large. End of story. Okay, so let's get back to the phones now. Let's go out to Jessica in Geneva. Go ahead, Jessica.
Hi, how are you, Evan?
Good.
Now, we've actually made acquaintance before. I'm Jessica Bryant. I'm an attorney now, so I have experience in both contracts and also in pageants. I was formerly Miss Salt City, representing the Syracuse region for the Miss New York State pageant, which goes to the Miss America pageant. And then I was Miss New York for the Miss International system. So generally these pageant systems are, you know, they're all separate businesses. And without focusing too much on Trump or really at all on Trump, as a pageant girl, we all sign these contracts. And essentially the frustration that I'm feeling, which I know is a very unpopular opinion coming from a woman, is that, you know, this Miss America, Miss
Universe.
You know, Miss Machado, she essentially was given a job to be Miss Universe, and her job entailed certain qualifications to look a certain way. And I think the frustration is that we're not talking about the issue of the fact that she stepped on stage to be judged for looking beautiful. I think that's equally concerning. And so as someone who's gone through the pageant system, who's struggled with you know, with weight issues, you know, even at a size 8 or a 10, I was often, you know, certainly one of the quote-unquote healthier-looking girls on stage. I was never the skinny one. But I went through a lot of periods of struggle of having to crash diet before a pageant just to look a certain way. And sure, when I got home from the Miss New York pageant, I absolutely bought every last Slim Jim at the gas station and scarfed it down in a second because I, you know, hadn't eaten all week. So I think that the problem is that we put so much focus on how women look, for better or worse. And it wasn't really until I became, you know, came into my own as an adult and focused on, you know, my education and my law degree that I learned to de-emphasize in my own mind the importance of looking a certain way. And that often does have the effect of, sure, yeah, if you're lost, you need to gain a little bit of weight because you're just focusing on other things. It's difficult to have it all and to do it all and to be it all. But, you know, when we're talking to young girls about weight issues, we really need to focus more on encouraging them to simply be healthy. Don't say, wow, have you lost weight? You look great. You need to say, wow, you know, I can tell you've been playing basketball a lot more. Your arms look so healthy and toned. You know, we really need to shift the conversation.
Jessica, do you think we should have pageants at all?
Well, you know, it's difficult. The Miss Universe pageant is a beauty pageant. You do get a score for how you look. The Miss America system prides itself because it is a scholarship competition, and the highest portion of your score comes from talent. And the judges are instructed. And if you watch the Miss America system, you'll see a very different type of body on stage. It's really focused on healthy, on being, you know, a little more athletic looking. And I think over the years, the pageant systems have really taken a lot of heat for that. And so they've shifted the focus. It's up to the judges to decide what looks good. But it's no secret that the Miss America system struggles for airtime, that the networks drop it because it's less popular and they're always fighting to get on some sort of TV show. Well, the Miss Universe and Miss USA pageant is always on television because it's the hot, skinny girls with the large chests. And, you know, it's just, unfortunately, the ratings have proven what people like to watch and what people want to see. So until that changes, I think that there are positive aspects, and girls can gain good things from participating in pageants. For me, you know, aside from helping pay for my education, it made me poised and well-spoken, you know, enhanced my interview skills. And to be honest, being a type A kind of girl, it was often hard to relate to my peers. And so to be among girls who, you know, you felt like understood you a little bit better and were into those same types of achievements, you know, that was, there obviously are good things about it, but it can go very wrong. And I know few pageant girls who haven't struggled with weight issues on a large or small scale.
Well, thanks for taking the time to call the program, Jessica. I appreciate you sharing your own story and the background there. And let me ask our doctors then. She started talking about what did work for her as she got older. She came into her own in adulthood. She thought about, you know, what was healthy for her as opposed to what standards others want to impose. And she clearly feels differently about that now. She feels, you can tell, more control, more confidence. But what does work? I mean, Dr. Campbell, let's start with this. When you've got clients, you've got patients come to you, whether it's a parent for a child or somebody talking, you know, in your own life, people probably want to talk to you about nutrition and health. What do you talk about? What is effective?
Well, I think starting from the 10,000-foot view, thinking about behavior change and, you know, trying to lose weight from a sense of getting healthy and for long-term health and for the things that you love in your life and that you're empowered to reach for these things, rather than as opposed to a position of feeling fearful, feeling bad about yourself, and feeling powerless. You know, that's sort of the dichotomy here that a lot of people struggle with. And I think getting to a point where you're, in my experience, some of the people who have lost weight most effortlessly were actually not focused on weight at all. They wanted to reduce their cholesterol. They wanted to reduce their blood pressure. They wanted to treat their heart disease or treat their diabetes. And they wanted it for long-term health, and they wanted it because they love their family. They love their kids. They want to be around for their grandkids. And this position of, you know, reaching for things that you love, that you feel empowered to reach for, is a much better long-term strategy.
Dr. Cook, how do you talk to patients about what works?
I think that's really important to understand kind of where people are and to not have them focus on really short-term type of things. What, you know, what can I see the scale change? And getting at, as Tom really described well, an external motivator, which may be good to start. I want to be healthier for my family, my kids. But then internalizing it, getting it to something that reaches their own intrinsic motivation and autonomy. And hopefully it's not what the number on the scale is. Because to say that obesity is a disease just based on a number, a weight, you know, I'm 300 pounds, I'm 6'2", is really inaccurate. Because some people may be very metabolically healthy at that size, and some may not. And some might be of less weight but have a number of obesity-related comorbidities. And that's actually a better way to describe a person's health status around it. So getting at their motivation, really you want to understand kind of what is the severity and what's going on. I mean, we do have to have behavior changes, even if it's a medical regimen, you know, a drug therapy. If it's going to work, you have to work because you take it, you know, just like high blood pressure. Some people don't want to take the medication. They may want to exercise and maybe even lose weight and eat a healthier plant-based diet or something, and they'll get some benefit. But if their blood pressure is still really high and they need medicine and they don't want to take medicine, you have to get at those same motivations. What is it? What are their barriers to taking it? What are the things that you can do to help them understand the importance of it? So I say that because some patients, you know, especially with excess weight, and not really children, but with adults, when there's severe comorbidities, something like bariatric surgery should be an option to consider, and it is an effective treatment. It's not the same as a motivation for having a healthy lifestyle, but it has to come from the same place, because you don't just do that surgery to someone. You have to have them in the right place. They have to be, you know, targeted and focusing on the right thing. So it is important to get them to identify the internal driver.
All right, I'm late for our only break of the hour, and when I come back, we're going to hear from some parents as well who want to weigh in and talk to the doctors on panel here as we talk about what works when it comes to achieving healthier bodies for kids, for our country. We are, as a country, we're overweight, but as Dr. Steve Cook just mentioned, that means different things for different people. Shaming doesn't work, but what does work? We're talking to Dr. Cook, who's an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics and the Center for Community Health at URMC, and Dr. Tom Campbell, chair of the Department of Family Medicine and executive director of the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Let's get that only break, and we'll come back to your phone calls next. And let me tell you what's coming up Tuesday on Connections. We're going to preview a new documentary about former Governor Mario Cuomo. The filmmaker is a Victor native who's now a journalist living in the Capital Region. We're going to talk to him about the film and his unexpected one-on-one interview with Governor Andrew Cuomo and what he learned. Then in our second hour, a local school is teaming up with the Special Olympics to pair with student athletes with and without intellectual disabilities on the same sports team. We'll talk about the Unified Sports Initiative. Welcome back to Connections here. We're laughing because, of course, when you've got doctors on the program whose titles, let's be honest, Dr. Campbell, could fill a page, Dr. Cook, you tend to get a few things on the wrong side. What's the full formal title? Go ahead, Dr. Campbell.
I'm the clinical director of the UR Program for Nutrition and Medicine.
Okay, see. Yeah. Sorry about that. Try to get the branding right and the titles right. You forgive me?
Of course.
I am sorry about that. Let me get back to your phone calls because I know several have been waiting. This is Pat in Canandaigua. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi there. We have a daughter who's morbidly obese. And I think we've done some of these things, trying to empower her to reach for her goals and focus on being healthy. But we're having a hard time really getting her to be serious, take it seriously. Right now, I mean, she does have trouble with mobility in some ways, but she hasn't suffered from severe obesity-related problems. Do you have any advice for helping her to take this seriously and thinking ahead to a future that is not bright?
Dr. Cook, you want to start?
Well, I think it's really important. I mean, it sounds like you're taking the right steps. And the reality is it's not as simple as there's a few things to do. You know, this being a discussion show, I think we have to be careful in terms of what it is we discuss. I will get calls from families about these same questions. The reality is to have an intensive type of behavioral treatment program in our region or in any region, it requires the right behavioral services, mental health services. It's not really about medical services per se. But the reality is that to run something like that is extremely costly. Getting in, you know, a young adult's attention and motivation around this also really requires the family. And I bring that up because effective programs actually show parent participation is the strongest predictor of child outcome. And parents in programs we've looked at and are exploring actually participate and have as much as a 10 or 15 pound weight loss. So I think it's really important to understand what the whole family is going through, what this young adult is going through. There may be a lot more internal kind of stress going on that she's worried about that it's difficult for her to talk about. So it's, you know, only having a half hour show and multiple questions, I would want to ask more, but I think it's important to really try to spend some time talking with her about, you know, what is important. I mean, this is a young adult age that nothing they see is life-threatening in terms of their health. I see teenagers all the time and engaging in many unhealthy behaviors because it's pretty much a mentality that they feel that they're pretty invincible and nothing they do at this age is going to harm them or hurt them. Or in this case, not doing something that's healthful is not going to be any type of risk to them either.
And where would we go in this area to get further help?
Well, that's the problem, is that we don't really have a comprehensive behavioral service in the area. And it's something that the health systems, I think, are looking at and discussing. But it's also something that the insurance companies, because of, you know, really requirements under the Affordable Care Act, should be covering and paying for. So it's something that does need patients to advocate for and going to their insurers and say, you know, we need help with this. Because it's something, it's not something a primary care pediatrician or a primary care doctor alone can really handle.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks, Pat, for the phone call. Good luck to you. Anything you want to add there, Dr. Campbell?
No, not too much. I mean, I totally agree with Dr. Cook in terms of the bigger picture and understanding that there's a whole emotional world in individuals that has to be tended to beyond just nutrition tips or simplistic kind of eat this, not that kind of tips. I would also highlight that I feel that the environment matters enormously to our health choices, and particularly for kids in general. I mean, the food at home, what's available at home, and what the family is eating is a huge determinant for what behaviors that child will have. So oftentimes, in my mind, I think actually focusing more on family choices and the home environment is probably likely to be of more yield than trying to change the behavior of a kid.
Dr. Campbell, Anna writes to the program and says we should be prescribing veganism. What do you think, Dr. Campbell?
Well, in our program, at the Nutrition and Medicine program, we do focus on what I like to call whole food plant-based diet. And that's focused more on food choice rather than eat less, exercise more for long-term health. And weight loss is a common goal, a common part of the long-term health. So if you change the food you eat and change the types of food you eat, that can be a very effective strategy, long-term strategy, and in so doing, changing your tastes and your taste preferences and forming new habits, rather than just eating, you know, one Oreo instead of three, which is not a very good long-term strategy.
By the way, Jane in Honeyoy Falls wrote in to say, perceptions of weight come at a young age. She used to work in an elementary school, and one of her second graders came up to her with a candy bar and said a classmate told her, that candy bar will make you fat. You know, it's one thing to say, let's try to curb the total candy intake, but to have people say, that's going to make you fat. I mean, Dr. Cook, you were nodding right away. You've heard stuff like that, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that stuff doesn't really occur in isolation. Children don't come up with that. And Tom's point of the environment in the home is a very key component to this. You know, unfortunately, I will often see families and have that question that comes up, and there's a parent with a weight issue. And I've talked to them on the side, and they describe a childhood and adolescence full of concern about weight and what they struggled with. And at times, the frustration that comes out of the parent, which sometimes almost seems like anger at the child, feels like it's a transference, that their struggles with their weight now is manifesting in their child. And so on top of their own personal failures, as mothers have said to me, it's an added failure as a parent. And so you have really deep, you know, emotional issues. So it's really important. We know there's a strong biology. I mean, the growing area of information is what happens prior and during pregnancy, what foods we eat, what type of weight gain women go through, and how that metabolically imprints on that fetus. So not everyone has that same genetic profile, but even within your genetic profile, certain things get turned on and off. And so to really try to simplify it as simple tips, as Tom is pointing out, is really short-sighted. So I do have a lot of concern because those messages start coming very early in life.
Jenna in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Jenna.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having me on. I have been surprised by the conversation. I'm a local fat activist and fat yoga teacher, and I use that word fat as just a way to describe my body. I don't think it has all the shame that our culture has made it, so I'm trying to shift that word, but it's actually been a very good conversation. I was expecting, you know, fat is bad, and I was expecting the doctors to say dieting is the only answer. So I'm calling to say I super appreciate the conversation and what the doctors are adding to it. I was just calling to, I don't know, just share shortly what has worked for me as a fat person. The first thing was to reclaim health, make health mean something to me. I had to do a lot of work about uncovering the messages that have influenced my relationship with my body, food, and exercise, and also going at it with a weight-neutral approach, like some of the doctors have said there, where it's health-centered and it's self-care-centered. So I've learned a lot about self-care and how that affects my health. And this includes self-love, kind of how I can cultivate self-love for myself and kind of increasing the diversity of beauty and bodies out there. So seeing more beautiful fat people made me feel like, oh, this is okay. It's okay for people to be fat and pretty. Our culture has a really hard time with fat people who are happy because in our culture, we are supposed to work towards a certain goal of aesthetics and health. So if a fat person is happy, the trolls online go out of their minds. But what's worked for me mostly is building a community of people who think the way that I think. So when I think of Pat calling about her daughter, I feel for her daughter because I grew up hating my body, my mom telling me you have to lose weight, and I don't blame her because that's what we do in our culture. But for her daughter, she's going to face many more obstacles based on kind of the culture that she's living in around this diet. So I've created just groups where people who are fat or people who take a weight neutral approach, we hang out, we chill out with each other, we do movement based activities that we like, that are joyful to us, we swap clothes so that we can save money and not buy tons of clothes that cost a lot of money, and that's what's really worked for me. So it's from something called the Body Positive Model, from a book called Embody, and I just wanted to share all that with everyone.
Well, Jenna, thank you for the phone call, and I appreciate that. I want to turn it over to the doctors on the panel now to address a couple of points here. First of all, you know, Jenna is talking about what has, number one, worked for her, but also her feeling of health and sort of taking control of that term, fat, et cetera. Dr. Cook, I'll start with you. When it comes to speaking generally, is it fair to say there is a goal of weight loss? I mean, every person is different. And you said someone metabolically could be healthier than somebody who is thinner, skinnier. So is weight loss, generally speaking, a goal, or is it more individualized person?
No, it really is more individualized. It doesn't have to be the goal. I mean, because if you break down weight in the simplest form, we don't know the difference between fat and muscle mass. And we know people with excess body fat are going to have a certain amount of excess muscle mass. So, you know, if someone's 300 pounds, it's not 200, you know, it's not 150 pounds of excess body fat. There's muscle mass in there. So it does need to be more than just lose weight, because you might get someone who exercises more, changes their diet around, has minimal weight change, blood pressure improves, cholesterol improves. So, you know, those are also really positive outcomes. So I really commend Jen for what she does. I remember seeing a story about her in the news recently, and it is really important. I try not to use the word obese or fat, and if we really talk about this, you know, with our trainees, medical students, residents, we know that it's really important to get them to think of saying, you know, don't worry about saying, is your child obese, or, you know, using those terms. It's, are they an unhealthy weight? Are they, you know, and do they have unhealthy habits with it that we can change?
But you're not saying that that kids who are severely overweight, that isn't a problem or something to be addressed.
you really have to look at it individually, because it's rare that there's not some comorbidity, some problem, whether it's a mental health or emotional or as a physical complication to it. But I think it is important to try to keep it neutral, keep it positive, and focus on the important points that Jen is talking about, is finding the positive nature within an individual. Because too often the frustration boils over very quickly, and then it becomes a negative discussion. You've got to lose this weight. This is disgusting, or something. And you really get yourself to a bad place very quickly.
Okay. Dr. Campbell?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a tightrope that we walk in a way. One is, on one side is behavior change and motivating people and finding things that make people tick. And on the other hand is the medical facts of obesity is a very serious risk factor for long-term health problems. We know obesity is linked to higher risk of diabetes, of high cholesterol, of high blood pressure. Not everybody who's overweight has these problems, but clearly there's a higher risk of that. Asthma, multiple types of cancer, which we can't tell based on metabolic testing. So, there's a medical serious issue here to address, and I don't think that we can ignore it or say it's. It's okay, just feel good about it. But on the other hand, we have to talk about it in a way that is separated from any sense of self-worth or self-value. You know, you are not worth, you're not worth it. You're I'm going to degrade you, or I'm going to put you down, that somehow that your self-worth is somehow related to your body shape or size. That gets extremely counterproductive. Very dangerous, poor motivation long term. So it's a tightrope. It's a balancing act. It's sometimes it's difficult because people listening are going to hear things in a slightly different way. But you kind of do the best you can.
Barb in Honeyway Falls is next. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi. I called in before to talk to you, Evan. But I lost 100 pounds from. 2008 to 2009. I've had it off since 2009, and I'm in a program that offers a lot of support. I work with four people daily on physical, mental, and spiritual aspects of what goes into making someone 100 pounds overweight and how you deal with that and get yourself down to a right-sized body. And a lot of it is the food in our culture. We take the position that flour and sugar are addictive substances, and avoiding those and then working with people on who have been there. I mean, I've lost 100 pounds, and I'm in a national study of people who have lost more than 30 pounds and had it off for more than a year. And it's really, really, really a big thing. And there's nothing like someone who's been there and walked through it and on the way out, really.
Well, Barb, can I just ask you a couple quick questions?
Sure.
When you were 100 pounds overweight, how long in your life were you that weight before you started to lose the weight?
I had been overweight, generally my whole life, about 20 to 30 pounds. And then over the course of the 80s and the 90s, I had gained up to 230 pounds.
Okay. So did you ever feel shamed or discriminated against?
Oh yeah. What people are talking about and the presidential candidate and all of this stuff is—it strikes right through the heart of people, and I think especially women. But there's a lot of men in my program too, who have suffered the ill effects of being hugely overweight or even a little bit overweight. People start with nastiness.
And what did the shaming do to you?
Well, it makes you feel horrible about yourself, and it perpetuates the problem because then you feel awful about yourself and you turn to food, which becomes a comfort in your life. And a lot of the food in America is heavily laden with sugar, flour, fat, and salt. It is not good for you. So it almost becomes a vicious circle that feeds itself. And to get out of that, to realize I am okay, and I can conquer this by someone help me every day with what I'm eating, how my mind is working into part of it, and how we have a spiritual connection. It kind of works like AA. But when I go to my meeting Thursday night, in my room, there are at least five people who have lost as much weight or more than I have and had it off for as long, if not longer. And one of the women I work with has had it off almost as long as me. And we continue to support each other on a regular basis. And it's programs like that, I think, are hugely helpful. And I wish it would grow. It's not easy, but it's not easy to be really fat in this culture either.
Yeah. Well, good.
And having been in both places, I can't tell you how grateful I am to be where I am. And I pass that on to people I work with every day.
Barbara, thanks for the phone call. Good luck to you. And I'm glad to hear you're doing well.
Thanks.
That's Barb in Honeyway Falls. Dr. Campbell, she's talking about flour and sugar in particular in her crosshairs as addictive to her and maybe to the population. Is there, scientifically, is that accurate?
Yeah, I appreciate that comment a great deal, actually, because apart from all the emotional stuff that we're talking about, there is some biochemistry here at work that works against the population at large and many individuals who are struggling with weight. And that is that added fats and added sugars, there is evidence that they have addictive properties. And we're constantly faced with these things every day. It's like smokers. You know, when someone quits smoking, one of the things they have to do is sort of stop going outside of the workplace to hang out with the other smokers. And in our culture, we're in a place where you simply can't get away from the tray of cookies and donuts in the break room, and the candied cereal in the supermarket, and that kind of environment, and the addictive properties of some of that food is an important part of all of this discussion as well.
Okay, Dr. Cook, want to add to that?
It is really important. I mean, as we're discovering more of the biology around addiction, they've done studies. They've looked at dopamine receptors in the brain that help with mood and depression, other factors, and they've seen certain abnormal patterns genetically in people with addictions, drugs, alcohol, gambling, variety of things. And in Buffalo, they did a study where they looked at people who went through an intensive weight loss program, and this is retrospectively, and then they looked at their DNA and found out who had these addictive patterns. And people who had the two bad alleles, the two bad genes for this, had the least amount of weight loss and the most amount of weight regain. So for them, was it food, whether it was sugar or fat? That may have been triggering that same receptor mechanism. So again, it's a neurobiology that's the case for some people. It's not as simple as one condition. It's not one pattern. And so we have to explore all those things. It's very important, as Tom's saying. And, you know, we know that certain things in our environment trigger lots of problems, whether it's a chemical that can trigger cells to become tumors, or is it certain, you know, we know lead poisoning and lead exposure in an infant and a growing brain is really toxic to the brain. But it's not the same if you're getting exposed when you're 35 and your brain's done growing. It's bad for your kidneys and other organs. But, you know, there's a susceptibility to this. And to think that food has no role in that, or that it's not a part of this, is really, really being short-sighted.
Here's an email from Anne Marie. She says, I'd like to hear the guests address skinny shaming. Many people do not want to accept that that's also a real issue. While current media the current media trend is to live your body, it is frequently done while shaming skinny women. And she goes on to say, being overweight can be unhealthy. We know this. It is not about loving your curves. It can be unhealthy. But being underweight is also not healthy. I wish people could focus on health and nutrition and less on weight. It's from Anne Marie.
She's absolutely correct. I mean, it's about health, and it's not about appearance or absolute number or weight, because she's right. You could have someone who's within a normal weight range or the low end of it and, you know, has, you know, really poor health status. So it's, you know, it's not a matter of just that simple number. She's absolutely right. The skinny shaming piece is something that, you know, I have heard discussed, and it falls under I've seen it around with youth, where it's just kind of just making fun of people around weight. And it's really kind of bizarre, but it is the same type of thing, and people can be very distressed by it.
Hmm. Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, I think there's a similar theme to both fat shaming, skinny shaming, and the theme is just judging by appearance, right? Self-worth is equal to appearance or body shape. And so sometimes you might see online, or you might have heard stories about the woman who delivers a baby 3 days later posts a selfie with a six-pack, right? And her abs, washboard abs. And the reason and rationale for doing that is to display some is somehow that, you know, this is a value, that this is a valuable thing to attain, and the way I look is good and something to show off. And so that's very similar in concept to this idea of there's an overweight person, they're not valuable, right, because of the way they look. So this overarching approach to self-worth and self-value and how we equate that with our body shape and body size is related to skinny shaming as well, and can be damaging in both directions.
And it's a great comment to help end the program. About 30 seconds, Dr. Cook, final thoughts from you?
Thank you so much for having us on. This is something that is pervasive across many domains and to really all ages and genders.
Yeah. Dr. Campbell, any final thoughts for the audience then?
No, this is a tough issue with many, many tentacles, but well worth talking about.
Yeah, and listeners, again, I think what we've learned this hour is that people are, you know, you can't look at one person and immediately understand exactly what their health status is. And if you've got questions, if I've got questions, if you've got family members who have questions, I'd go see your doctor and talk about it. You know, they've got good ways of helping you understand what's healthy and what's a healthy weight for you, et cetera. But to shame people, to name call, to denigrate people, especially women, but all people, based on their size and what we in society expect of them, I don't know why that's tolerated at all. And no, I don't think it's funny either. Dr. Campbell, great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Cook as well. Always appreciate the time from both of you. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk with you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.